Today's program is a discussion of landlord-tenant issues in Hawaii. And joining us today are Dan O'Meara, Managing Attorney for the Legal Aid Society and Project Director of its Fair Housing Enforcement Program.
Joining us by phone from Hawaii Island is Barbara Franklin, a practicing attorney with an office in Honoka'a who works on landlord-tenant issues.
And also in the studio with us this morning is Marcus Kawatachi, Deputy Director of the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission.
And also by phone, Julie Mitchell, Executive Director of the Kuikahi Mediation Center.
And welcome to you all. Today we're talking about landlord-tenant issues, and we're asking you, the listener, to weigh in. We actually decided to hold a program focusing on landlord-tenant issues because we did get some calls from our listeners who were saying that the reason why they are doing vacation rentals is because they've had bad experiences with long-term tenants. And what are you seeing out there, you know, as far as the complaints that legal aid comes across?
Well, for legal aid, we tend to focus on tenants only. So we don't get people here who have our vacationers who are asking for problems. Our issues tend to be more with paying rent. We see security deposit issues. We see issues with some items not getting repaired and fixed in time. We see issues with comfort animal assistance animals. We also see issues with domestic violence and how women are treated. So those are some of the things that tend not to be in the vacation rental arena.
And as far as the civil rights, what are you seeing?
Well, just as a little background, the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission is the state agency that enforces our state's anti-discrimination laws in a number of areas. So we have employment, we have places of public accommodation, state-funded services, as well as housing. And so in the housing context, we don't get all the complaints that deal with landlord-tenant issues, just those that deal with housing discrimination or fair housing. And we've seen a fair number of complaints every year. The largest number are dealing with disability-related issues, and particularly with assistance animals. There's a lot of, I suppose, uncertainty and perhaps misinformation out there with regard to assistance animals as they pertain to housing. So that's one area. We've seen we've seen cases dealing with sexual harassment, harassment of various kinds. But it's a real variety of issues. But I will say that disability has been our number one area of concern for a while.
What's an example of an issue surrounding disability, Marcus?
Well, I think the number one issue is with tenants and residents who, because of their disability, are requesting as an accommodation an animal. And assistance animal is the broad term used to describe those types of animals. So a lot of people focus on service animals, and there's a particular definition for that. Mm-hmm. And the definition varies in the context. So we have a definition of what an assistance animal is for accommodations in housing as opposed to, say, public accommodations, so places like stores, restaurants, etc.
As we've learned on this show before, there's all kinds of definitions of a service animal, and you can go on the internet for $20 and get something that identifies your dog as a service animal when it's just something you got for $20, right?
Well, I think if you're talking about a legal status, there really is one type of service animal, mm-hmm. which is an animal that is needed for someone's disability and is trained to perform a particular task. Mm-hmm. One thing I should note is in terms of the certification, there is no certification process on the federal, state, county level, any level. There's no official certification process. And that definition of service animal is very different from a broader definition of assistance animal, which would include animals that are not trained to perform particular tasks. Those, go ahead.
No, the lawmakers did pass a bill that would require stiffer penalties for folks who are trying to pass off their animals as comfort animals or service animals. And I know your organization testified against it because you thought it was going to maybe hurt the folks with the true disability.
Well, yes, that's correct. I mean, we could spend all day talking about that, but I guess really what I want to emphasize is in the housing context, both federal law of the land as well as our Hawaii state law allow assistance animals generally to be reasonable accommodations for persons with disabilities. So those are not confined strictly to service animals. It could be an animal which, by nature of it being an animal, provides comfort to a person. So typically, they might be described as emotional support animals, comfort animals, support animals. Those are all legitimate, possibly legitimate, reasonable accommodations for people with disabilities, not just the service animal.
So how does that work? If, let's say, I have a unit that's, where no pets are allowed,
right,
and you rent to someone and you don't know they have a disability, and then maybe 3 months later they say, oh, I need to have a comfort animal, then that has to be the reasonable accommodation?
Right. So what a reasonable accommodation is an exception to some sort of rule, policy, or practice. And if we're talking about the housing context, this comes up quite often, is the landlord or owner might not know from the start that the potential tenant is going to need an assistance animal. But at some point, that becomes apparent. The person makes a request. At that point, that's a request for an exception to that no pets policy. And so under state and federal law, assistance animals generally can be accommodations, but the housing provider can require certain verification that the person has a disability and that the accommodation is needed for the disability.
We're inviting listeners to call in and talk about landlord-tenant issues. If you're a tenant, if you're a landlord, we want to hear from you. The number is on Oahu 941-3689, on Neighbor Islands 1-877-941-3689. And we also have with us by phone, we have Julie Mitchell, Executive Director of the Kuikahi Mediation Center. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
I gather you see a number of cases that come before you as a mediator?
Yeah, so we get referrals from all the agencies that are on the phone. So Marcus, Civil Rights Commission. We tend to get a lot of employer-employee relations, mediations from them, civil rights-related, and then also legal aid and attorneys. We can mediate, which means you're sitting two parties down who have some kind of problem with one another, and we provide neutral third parties who can help them talk it out. So anyone can initiate it, the landlord or the tenant, and all the issues that have been mentioned so far, repairs, security deposits, eviction, breach of the housing agreement, fair housing issues, we can help people with all of those. And we can do it at any step in the process. So, of course, we'd like it best if it was the earliest as possible before people contact an attorney or before they file in court, because then you can get it early on before the problem mounts up and there's 3 months of back rent or what have you. And then also we do it at any stage in the process. So we are in small claims court where a lot of the landlord-tenant issues come. So mm-hmm. if the judge says, hey, there's a problem here and you're both here, why don't you go sit with the mediators and see if you can resolve it, and then we don't have to do a trial. So that's also possible. And just to let you know, Kuikahi Mediation Center serves East Hawaii. However, there are 5 nonprofit community mediation centers in the state, so every island is served by one of these nonprofit community mediation centers. And we have a similar contract with the judiciary, so we're there on site in the small claims court to help people with these problems.
In your experience, Julie, is mediation a good way to go for a tenant-landlord dispute?
Absolutely. I think one of the most exciting things to me about mediation, it's very creative. So when you're in the legal realm with attorneys and the court, they're limited. They must rule on the law. They've got to follow the Hawaii Landlord-Tenant Code. In mediation, you can have any sort of creative solution that the two people work out. So, for example, maybe what the landlord wants is they just really want the tenant to move out. They've not been a good tenant. They really don't expect to receive any payment of the back rent. But if they get something during mediation and the negotiation, they're happy. And then the tenant who has found another place already, they didn't like this landlord anyways, they thought they were going to owe a lot of back rent, and maybe they make a token payment. They both feel like they came out with a win-win. So that's what we're going for, is both parties volunteering to be there. So it's a voluntary process. both parties investing in flexibility, negotiating a mutually satisfying solution, and then both people walking away feeling like they were successful in their solution and they got what they were coming for. So that's why I think the courts and a lot of attorneys like to use mediation, because we have the time. You know, we can spend, if it's at court, it might be 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour for the mediation. But if they come to our offices, they can have 2-3 hours to talk it out. If you go before the judge, your trial is very short. You know, you don't have a lot of time with the judge.
And is it the hope that mediation then could prevent evictions?
Absolutely. So, I mean, the earlier we can get in there, we can prevent evictions. We can prevent people from maybe sliding into homelessness. And a lot of times there's been a miscommunication. Or when the landlord hears the true situation of somebody, like let's say they've had a really good job, they lost it, and then their husband is sick. You know, people have compassion. So they go, oh, I didn't realize all that was going on with you. Let's see if we can work a payment plan, or let's see what resources are available. Because when people fall on hard times, luckily Hawaii has some programs like LIHEAP and other rental assistance programs that a lot of the homeless service providers have, or the Office of Housing has and knows about, because they are also invested in keeping people from being homeless. So there are financial resources for people who are falling on hard times to get them through until they're, you know, out the other end of whatever financial or medical or personal crisis they're having.
Thanks, Julie. Julie Mitchell is the executive director of the Kuikahi Mediation Center. And, Julie, we're going to have you stay on the line for the remainder of the program, but we also want to check in with Barbara Franklin. She's a practicing attorney with an office in Honoka'a on Hawaii Island who works on landlord-tenant issues. Barbara, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for asking me to have some input into this. The question that you started out with was, you know, an expression of people saying, I want to get out of the landlord-tenant market because it's just too difficult. And one of the things that I think I would really rather encourage them to step back and take a look at it and try again, because there are a number of steps that landlords can take in the very initial inception of a landlord-tenant agreement to make sure that it's going to work right and make sure that there's a clear understanding of what's expected, that sort of thing. You know, Hawaii law does allow for an oral agreement, but I, as a lawyer, I discourage that because it doesn't help set the expectations of the parties. The Hawaii Board of Realtors has a form that's available online. It's free. It comes with an inventory and condition form that, if landlords would fill that out carefully, give a copy to a tenant, and then when the rental agreement is over with, go through the property again, make sure everything is the way it's supposed to be, or note if there's a damage item that should be corrected, that it may come from the security deposit. Those kinds of things are really, really important to do. The other thing that I would always encourage landlords to do is to also establish some house rules and put them in writing and attach them to the agreement. Things like, you know, if there's a shared washer and dryer, you know, who gets to use what.
Barbara, let me just interrupt you for a second, because we've got a landlord on the line from your neck of the woods, from Honoka'a. Jerry, can you hear me?
Yes.
You're a landlord with several rental units. What has your experience been?
Oh, it's generally been good. Tenants have been good, and this is the country, so people are pretty accommodating, and we try to be accommodating. I have a question, though. Can I ask that?
Of course.
I have a disabled person, don't doubt the disability, who wants to bring their disabled pet into my unit, and I'm not averse to it, but they want the pet deposit to be waived, and I just wondered if anybody had a perspective on that issue. Normally, if somebody had a pet and I allowed the pet, there would be a deposit, but this disabled person says that they don't have to pay or can't be charged a deposit because that would be discriminatory. So that's the question.
Dan O'Meara of the Legal Aid Society.
They're right. It's not for a comfort animal. It's not considered a pet, so there is no pet deposit. You cannot charge a deposit for that comfort animal, which isn't to say you can't recover for damages and things at the other end. It's just that you can't charge as if it's a pet because it's not treated as a pet.
Who defines that?
The state.
Comfort animal?
No, I mean pet.
Okay, but I mean, when you say it's a comfort animal, not a pet, who decides? And you know,
oh, if they go through the process, like Marcos was talking about, if they go through the process of providing the documentation as a disability, which in this case it sounds like he didn't necessarily need documentation. He knew it was a case. And if there's some certification that this animal is addressing some need of the – fulfilling some need of the disabled person, then that puts them into the comfort animal or assistance animal category.
If I could add, I think sometimes people get tripped up over the terminology, I mean both on the landlord and on the tenant side. Because, sir, you're talking about the person with a disability and pet, and it's very common for people to sort of conflate terms. So if the person is coming to you with an animal that he or she is alleging alleviates one or more symptoms of his or her disability, that's alleged, you know, claimed to be an assistance animal, not a pet. So there are steps you can go through to verify the legitimacy of the request and the need for the animal. But if indeed it is that type of animal, then it's not a pet, and so a pet fee would be unlawful in that circumstance.
We had a situation, too, where there was a woman claiming to need comfort chickens, and I believe there was a case that the civil rights dealt with on comfort rabbits.
Right. Well, assistance animals in housing can take a number of forms. In other contexts, they may be relegated to just dogs. And possibly miniature horses, which are amazing creatures, by the way. But chickens, birds, rabbits, etc., they potentially can be legitimate assistance animals in housing. There are a number of steps one would have to go through to verify the need for that particular animal. But again, they can be.
There's a dog trainer on the line, Amy from Waikiki. You wanted to weigh in on this. Hi, Amy.
Hello. I'm really appreciating this segment, this conversation. So I know that it's difficult when defining comfort versus assistant versus service dogs. And the bottom line, though, to me, is if let's assume that the pet coming in is legitimate. If that pet is disruptive, if they're antisocial toward other pets in the building, people in the building. If the dog isn't leashed, under control, if the person doesn't pick up after the pet's waste, or if the dog is noisy and disrupting other people in the building, there are other laws on the books to take care of that. I mean, those should be in the building documents.
Thanks, Amy. Correct. We're asking listeners to join in this discussion of landlord-tenant issues. The number, if you're on Oahu, is 808-941-3689. There's a toll-free number. You can reach us from anywhere else, 1-877-941-3689. We have with us in the studio Dan O'Meara, managing attorney for Legal Aid Society's Housing and Consumer Unit, Marcus Kawatachi from the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission, and by phone we have Julie Mitchell, Executive Director of the Kuikahi Mediation Center, and Barbara Franklin, landlord-tenant attorney with Island Law on Hawaii Island.
We do have a landlord from the Puna area who wrote in and said the primary issues he believes are caused by the court system. The law allows a court case to be filed 5 days after a notice is given for late rent. Unfortunately, it's often 2 weeks or longer before a court date is available. If the tenant denies owing rent at the first answer hearing, another proof hearing court date is set another 2 or more weeks away. That's a whole month of rent that will likely never be paid, despite notices given and court actions started as early as possible. At the same time, he says, I hear lots of horror stories about landlords who fail to maintain their rentals to any reasonable standard. The court system should be more available and effective for addressing those issues, too.
Barbara Franklin, you're a landlord-tenant attorney. Is that accurate in your experience?
Yes, that's accurate. I think, you know, I represent both landlords and tenants, and I've seen sort of both sides of that. One of the things that a landlord can do at that first return date is to make a request for a rental trust fund. And there is a form that's available online to do that on the Hawaii Judiciary website under court forms. That rental trust fund requires that the tenants pay the rent whatever the court and decides on that particular day as to when the due date is and how much. And if they don't pay, then the landlord can get a writ of possession immediately. So that is one tool that's available to landlords to sort of mitigate that long amount of time. I recently had a landlord ask for that. We asked for it, and the court granted it. But then later on that very same day, the tenants who were disputing it actually turned in the keys and vacated the property. And so we ended up having a damages hearing after that. So that did shorten the amount of time that he was able to get in there and relet the place, but that doesn't always happen. I agree that that it does seem to take extra time. I think, you know, the way the court sets landlord-tenant hearings, they may set them for particular districts only one day out of the week and only certain weeks out of the month, and so that does stretch it out. Again, I sort of go back to making really clear agreements and then making sure that you promptly take action whenever there is a default rather than stretching it out and you know, giving them extra chances, because sometimes that doesn't really prove to be a good strategy.
Dan O'Meara, a managing attorney for Legal Aid Society's Housing and Consumer Unit, has that been your experience that if these things are agreed to in advance, you can head off a lot of trouble?
Oh, for sure. I mean, and I'm guessing Barbara would agree, is that if tenants would communicate with the landlord about their issues, they could head off a lot of these things and avoid the eviction. I mean, landlords aren't looking to evict people typically because it's expensive and time-consuming, as you pointed out. So, yes, if they would just let them know we're going to be late with the rent or can we do something about the rent, those sorts of things, it makes a huge difference. But it's like a lot of things. People tend to ignore it until it's too late.
We should point out to our listeners that we did invite representatives from the property management companies. We did reach out to two of them. One declined and the other didn't respond. I want to bring up this example. I was a renter when I lived in San Francisco, and we had a situation where our hot water heater went out, and the landlord was not very timely in making the repairs. And so what we did, all the tenants got together when we put our rent in an escrow account, in order to force the landlord to take some action, because we went for months without hot water. And Dan, in talking with you earlier ahead of the show, you were saying that's not possible here in Hawaii.
No, if you did that, you'd probably be evicted, because if you don't pay your rent, the landlords have every right to evict you. Here, it's a different procedure. They have a repair and deduct procedure in which a tenant notifies the landlord of an issue. Typically, it's best to do it in writing, and then once you do it in writing, it sets in certain time frames for which the landlord has to repair the item. And if it's not repaired, the tenant can then pay for it, fix it, and deduct a certain amount of that from their rent the next month. So it's a different procedure, but you're right. And we see that. It's like, I'm going to get the landlord's attention. I'm not going to pay the rent for whatever reason. Something
right.
Didn't fix. Bad strategy, because you then end up getting behind in your rent, and you're likely getting going to be evicted.
We had an attorney in our building, and that was where the idea came up with of putting it in escrow, saying in good faith we were paying our rent, but we want the hot water fixed because we're not getting, you know, what we signed up for.
Yeah, so. If you come, there's some states that don't allow any of those protections. I mean, there's just depends on what state you're coming from, what you're used to, because some states have very, very little protection for tenants and getting repairs taken care of. Hawaii at least has some protection with the repair and deduct provisions.
But there are other states that have more protections for tenants?
California did, where they let them escrow it, which is, you know, a strategy. You escrow the money, put it aside, and the landlord knows the rent's there, and they can then, they know they're going to get it once the repair is done or whatever is fixed, whatever problem is fixed. But not here. It doesn't work that way here.
Is there anything else that sets Hawaii aside from maybe other states? I don't know.
Well, you know, we've got some recent, there's the medical marijuana. There's the landlord-tenant code specifically addresses medical marijuana that basically somebody can smoke if they are, if it's a smoking building. So in that case, that's, I think Barbara mentioned, if you have your rules and it's a non-smoking building, it doesn't work. One big difference there is with medical marijuana is that if it's in public housing, you can't do it, period. The landlord-tenant code doesn't apply to public housing, and because it's federally subsidized, the federal laws apply, and you simply can't do it. And we had a client who was growing his medical marijuana in his bedroom in public housing, and he was convinced he could do that, and, well, he was wrong. And they also have some new laws and recent laws in Hawaii about domestic violence in tenants that now allow a tenant who is a victim of domestic violence to be able to get out of their lease early without penalty, provided they have a police report or a temporary restraining or something that shows that the domestic violence is occurring. So now that's a way for a victim to be able to leave early. It doesn't let them stay or kick out the other person and not pay rent, but it lets them leave early if it's a private landlord-tenant situation.
On the medical marijuana issue, I know, I think it was Associa Hawaii said that a lot of the properties that they manage, they have certain rules that deal with noxious odors, so that would fall under that category?
Yeah, there's different ways to approach it, because you could have your house rules that maybe allow smoking, but doesn't allow, you know, to make garlic or whatever it is that's going to smell bad. Marijuana might fit in that category.
The issues just keep cropping up like that, don't they? There's a caller on the line from Hilo. Can you hear me?
Hello?
Hi, Joe. You had an issue you wanted to discuss?
Yes. A friend of mine just went through the long process of evicting
I'm losing you, Joe. You got to speak up a little louder.
Okay, a friend of mine just recently went through the court process to have someone evicted from their home. They've obtained the writ, but the sheriff's department here are now not executing or assisting in the writ. Question is for the attorney, where does a landlord go to have someone execute an eviction?
This is Barbara. I can answer that question. There is an article in the West Hawaii Today about it, and it seems to be a continuing issue. The sheriff's office on the island of Hawaii, County of Hawaii, is not assisting with forcible evictions. When it gets down to the time where you've tried everything to get the tenant out, and the tenant absolutely refuses to leave or cannot or whatever, the recourse is the order, the writ of possession directs law enforcement to conduct the forcible eviction, where they can go in, they can literally physically remove the person and their property. But what is happening on this island is that you have to contact the Maui Sheriff's Office, and then the Maui Sheriff's Office will potentially respond and deal with it. Of course, you have to pay their costs.
To fly over from Maui?
I mean, Yeah, exactly.
Wow. That's crazy.
I don't know if they send one person or two persons. I'm assuming that they may send two persons if you've got a tenant that is being rather, let's say, belligerent about leaving. So it adds to the cost considerably.
I would imagine it's also one of law enforcement's least favorite things to do.
Correct.
So in practice, how does that work out, Barbara? I mean, having a couple of cops come over from Maui, that's going to run into the thousands pretty quickly, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to run into, you know, anywhere from 5,000 or more, depending on how many trips they have to make. And if they have to hire a moving van to get the material out and change the locks, and, you know, there's a lot that would have to be done under their supervision, and in order to, you know, get a tenant to move off the property that doesn't want to.
That puts a landlord in a pretty tough spot, doesn't it?
Exactly. And that's, you know, that's a very difficult position for a landlord to be in. That's why I think it's important to set up the agreement with the tenant ahead of time and be very, very firm about sticking to that agreement.
How would you word that, Barbara?
There's lots of language in the agreement that's put out by the Hawaii Board of Realtors. I think asking for their Social Security number, asking for, you know, verification of employment, that sort of thing, and keeping up with the landlord's duties of, you know, doing an inspection. You have to give at least 48 hours notice for an inspection, but to inspect on a relatively routine schedule, depending on how long they're going to be there, and see, you know, if you get some pushback, that may be an indication that things aren't going quite the way you want them to. So,
well, Barbara, let me, how would getting a tenant's Social Security number, how would that help if they're going to be a really problematical tenant of the kind you describe?
Well, it helps if you have to later garnish on a judgment. Mm. If you have to later try some collection steps, then you would want the Social Security number.
You know,
obviously can't put that on any of the court documents. You can only use the last four, but just having that may give you a leg up if you have to try to collect later on.
You know, one issue that I would like to bring up is in discussions that we had with our in-studio guests prior to the show, this issue of tenants' rights when it comes to, let's say, these monster homes where you have landlords who are renting out to more tenants than they can legally, and if the city comes in and shuts them down, what are the tenants' rights? You know, are they out on the street because of, you know, something that the landlord did? Dan,
well,
you want to mention
potentially
talk about that?
The tenant, yes, could be out if they're in the terms of their lease. I mean, the lease gives them protection that they're at least entitled to 45-day notice from a landlord under almost any circumstance, and if they're during the term of their lease, they still have the lease term. So the landlord is putting themselves at risk by that situation, because they could be liable for some relocation costs, for cutting short the lease. They might have to negotiate with the tenant to say, okay, I'll give you back your security deposit now so you can find a new place. They might have to put them up in a hotel, that sort of thing, because the tenant didn't create the situation. The landlord created the situation by renting an illegal unit. So, yeah, it's a problem, and it's a problem for the tenants, problem for both parties. But you, regardless of whether the monster home is good, bad, or otherwise, you do have the person in that, living there, that needs a place to live. And so relocating them is generally going to fall on their shoulders, but they can expect or should look to the landlord to at least alleviate some of that or mitigate some of the problems with relocating.
Is there anything specifically you should have in the contract that spells out that? So you have that protection, or is
you could. I mean, but then you'd be acknowledging that if this is an illegal unit and I have to leave, then here's what my rights are, and most landlords aren't going to want to put that in writing that I'm renting out an illegal unit, and what your rights would be. I mean, it's theoretically it's possible. It's a tough one, though.
One of the things that we see is that communication is an issue all around. I'm hearing that from everyone in the conversation.
Yes.
People don't know. I think we'll, all the time in mediation, we'll see people, landlords, they're not familiar with the rule, what the law is. The tenants aren't familiar with the law. Sometimes during the mediation, while we're talking to one party, we'll ask the other one as they go out, are you familiar with the landlord-tenant code? Not really. Why don't we give you a copy to look at while you're waiting? And then we switch and we do the same thing, and we bring them back into joint session. They both realize that they've not really, either one of them, been following the rule of the law, and they realize when they, if they go to court, they're both going to get dinged for things they've done. And I really like Barbara's idea. When things are clear up front in writing and it's all spelled out, it's much less problem at the front, at the back end. I can't tell you how many times in mediations people kind of have a vague oral agreement or sort of a funky written agreement. It's very hard later when in mediation we're like, so what rent did they pay? And the landlord is like pulling out these paper receipts and they're not really in order, organized. They don't really know how much they've collected. So some shoddy bookkeeping all around. And when, if people are willing to communicate early, just I forget who suggested it, may have been Don, but if you're having problems making your rent, just going and talk to the landlord early. But people have a hard time communicating directly. Also, mediation can happen quicker than court, so people could file in court and concurrently seek out mediation and see if during the time it's taking the trial to get set and all that, they can sit down and work it out in mediation, which, you know, once the intake's been done for two people, we can get them into mediate within 1 or 2 weeks often.
That's Julie Mitchell. She's the executive director of the Kuikahi Mediation Center in East Hawaii, and there's a caller on the line from Pahoa who's a landlord. Linda, can you hear me?
Yes.
You have a tenant?
Yes, there's a tenant who's been in the rental for, probably 8 months or so, and decided not to pay rent 1 month after being issued a request to clean up, and hasn't been paying rent. And I'm wondering if, one, they're on disability, and two, even if I do end up going to court and getting a judgment, can you garnish disability? That, and then also kind of what some of these other people were saying, I heard, everything is not all ducks in a row kind of thing, so it may be challenging.
So, Linda, your question is, can disability money be garnished?
Yeah, no. or somehow, I guess garnished is the best word.
No.
Dan O'Meara of the Legal Aid Society. Dan?
With people with, generally speaking, somebody has to have, I think it's $924 a month or $944 a month in order for them to be garnished, their wages to be garnished. That's after taxes, but there's certain types of income that aren't going to be garnished by a private party, such as retirement and Social Security and disability. Those aren't going to be able to be garnished. They could be garnished if it was the IRS coming after you. They could garnish those things, but you as a landlord are not going to be able to.
What about tenants who have children and might be discriminated against because they have a family, and they may not know they're being discriminated against, you know, as they put in their application? What are you folks seeing out there?
Well, yeah, that would fall under familial status discrimination, which means a family with one or more children under the age of 18. And so that is a category that we see fairly often. And as you point out rightly, the people may have a suspicion that they're being discriminated against, but there's no hard proof. And so people may inquire with our office, and we go over the situation. And if they have, from their perspective, some reasonable belief that they are being discriminated against, they can file a complaint. And what goes forth from there would be the investigation, and we look at how other families or single folks have been treated with and without children. I will say that there are many different ways that that type of familial status discrimination can take shape. It could be a landlord simply not wanting to have families with minor children. It could be a landlord not wanting to rent certain units, like ones on higher floors, for example. So anything that would tend to limit the opportunities of families with minor children might be considered some form of familial status discrimination.
What about, let's say, extended families? You know, you're a landlord, right, and you rent to a family, and then their cousin comes in, and, you know, and all of a sudden you've got like a dozen people living in a unit where you thought there was just going to be maybe two or three.
Right. Well, I mean, that's a situation that's not uncommon, right, in Hawaii. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is the protection extends only to families with minor children, right? So if you have, you know, adult cousins coming in, that's not part of the analysis. But assuming that there are minor children coming in, you know, there are certain obligations that a tenant needs to abide by informing, you know, of new people on the lease, that type of thing. But potentially, yes, I mean, there could be discrimination based upon the addition of, you know, more minor children.
Catherine, we've only got a couple minutes left before we check in with Hawaii Island, but I want to ask our guests, we've heard an emphasis on communication, and is that maybe the most important thing you would see to avoid the problems that come your way?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, denial is huge with people who are having struggling with money or problems. I mean, everybody does it probably in some respect, but absolutely, communication is a big one, and our clients are in as much denial as anybody when it comes to their financial woes.
Barbara?
I would say knowing the Landlord-Tenant Act, and there is also a telephone number called Landlord-Tenant Hotline. It's 808-586-2634. And that is the Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs. They are available 8 to 5 to answer questions from landlords and tenants. And you can also download the handbook.
Thank you, Barbara. Marcus?
Oh, yes. Communication is essential in any situation. And I do like the suggestions of our other guests to make sure to have an awareness of the law, have some policies and procedures in place in advance, and to apply them consistently. And that's where people get in trouble, is they apply things, even if they have a good policy, applying them inconsistently, that could lead to claims of discrimination.
And that was Marcus Kawatachi, Deputy Director of the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission.
And if your call didn't make it on the air during today's discussion, you can still contact the Talkback line and leave your comments. That number is 808-792-8217.
We'd like to thank our guests for this program, Landlord-Tenant Attorney Barbara Franklin, Julie Mitchell of the Kuikahi Mediation Center, Marcus Kawatachi from the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission, and Dan O'Meara, Managing Attorney for Legal Aid Society's Housing and Consumer Unit.
You can also email us your comments at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you want to listen back to today's show, check out the Conversation Podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.